Cut.
Welcome to the Ink Drop. I'm your host, Matthew McGebna. Just to get something out of the way right away, I'm sort of battling a head cold. Last week there was no episode because the weekend I was going to record and cut one, I got sick with strep. Now I've got like this head cold. I'm full of medicine. So my voice probably sounds different as well. I'm also have no idea what my voice sounds like because I'm also going without headphones, which I probably shouldn't do, but I'm just not in the mood. So apologies right away if my voice sounds a little strained or if I do some throat clearing, both figuratively and literally for this podcast. This week I'm actually thinking again about sensitivity readers. And I've commented on this before on social media and other places, on this podcast as well, but never really fully addressed, I had a really thought out idea about it or discussion about it. And again, so if I say anything really stupid, just blame it on the medicine. The medicine gave me stupid head. But sensitivity readers, yeah. I think it's important, first of all, to... it would be important probably to steel man the sensitivity reader because I want to be fair and I want to be reasonable about it. That is to say, you know, the spirit behind sensitivity reading a work of fiction or poetry, I think, is a good one. Any reasonable person would have to admit that living here in America, growing up in pretty much every decade prior to the internet, we got a lot of our impressions, our first impressions about people, ethnicities, religious groups, sexual orientations, even genders outside of our own, from television shows, movies, books, cartoons, etc. So I'm not going to pretend that how these groups are portrayed doesn't have an impact on the overall cultural impressions that we carry with us into our adult lives. And some of these impressions are inaccurate and hurtful. So I don't think there's any point in denying that reality. I think this is also why it's such a huge issue in the young adult fiction genre. I mean, it certainly seems intuitive, you know, if you can head off these false and hurtful portrayals at all, you should probably do it with young readers because they do carry these impressions with them on into old age. They develop biases without ever having faced the realities. They have preconceived notions about people in certain groups. They don't know where it comes from, but I certainly can speak for my generation, and our fear of sharks probably came from Jaws. And you know, look how many episodes of Shark Week and National Geographic did we have to watch before we realized that sharks are actually relatively harmless, that it's a very, very rare occasion, and that they don't actually hunt you down the way they do in Jaws. Young readers are impressionable, and young readers can come away with false impressions about groups, and I think it's important to try to combat that. Just the other day, I was actually watching one of those old-timey cartoons, I guess, you know, like cartoons from maybe the 50s and 60s with my 12-year-old. I think it was an old Bugs Bunny cartoon, and Bugs Bunny, you know, says, "What's up, Doc?" to a Native American chief. And the chief turns to look at him, and he literally says, "Ooga booga." Not kidding, right? And my son, to his credit, looked at me and was like, you know, WTF, right? He was like, did he just say ooga booga for real? Take a listen to this. This is interesting. My mother now bought me this record. This is a record I'm going to play for you, 45, when I was a little boy. It's a recorded version of Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe. This actual record I'm holding in my hand, I would put this story on my record player every night and fall asleep to this story. And I would alternate between this and The Bremen Town Witches, which is on my shelf also. I still haven't. But give this little section a listen here. And again, apologies for the audio, but it's, you know, it's a 40-year-old 45 record. So what do you want?
Several years passed, and still there was no sign of anyone. Then, one night, I dreamt a man running away away from cannibals, arrived here, and became my servant. The thought of a companion pleased me, but it was only a dream. A year later, I saw canoes heading towards the island. On shore, a figure was running in my direction. He was being chased by two cannibals. Suddenly, I remembered the dream. I must save that poor fellow from the savages. The native was grateful I had saved his life. My dream was answered. I now had someone to talk to. I began to teach the native to speak. I told him his name was Friday, for that was the day I saved his life. Friday. Friday.
Friday.
That afternoon, the canoes left quietly. I gave him food and clothing and made him a bed. As time passed, I taught Friday to help with the work. Friday, you learn very fast.
Friday, dig field.
These became the happiest years I spent on the island. Friday could now speak English quite well, and he often made me laugh. Then, one morning...
Master, Master Crusoe, a ship has come.
Now, when my 9-year-old uncovered this dusty old thing and started playing it here in my studio, I was a little appalled. Again, my 9-year-old was like, "Savages, Dad? What's with the way he's speaking? WTF?" Right? So, many of our impressions of races, ethnicities, cultures, languages, religions that are outside of our own are delivered to us from these subtle and not so subtle vehicles, right? Cartoons, movies, audiobooks, like the one I just played. And I think to deny that is to, well, it's to almost willfully refuse to engage in this issue in a serious manner, right? I mean, as a writer, why would you even write if you didn't believe that your words could have the potential to impact the society in which you live? So it stands to reason, right here in 2023, if we can avoid referring to people in our fiction as savages or replicate another culture's language by writing Ooga Booga, that would be a good thing, right? Now, those are obvious and blatant examples, and I doubt that any writer today is using that kind of language or framing things that way. But there are subtler words and phrases, subtler tropes and character functions that can play into creating hurtful impressions about people. For example, in 2021, a team of sensitivity readers working for Picador to read ahead of the second print run of Kate Clancy's memoir, Some Kids I Taught and What They Taught Me, had these things to say about her book, which she'd written about. She'd written a memoir about teaching English in a diverse public school in England. You know, her memoir, she caught a lot of flack for her memoir and in the first run. So, but the memoir had sold very well, was a bestseller, done enormously well. And so Picador was going to reprint the second edition. But before they did so, because of the online backlash that Kate Clancy kind of faced, they went out and they hired these sensitivity readers to look over what she'd written and to offer some feedback. And she wrote, I'll put a link in the show notes, but she wrote kind of an essay on Unheard magazine that basically documented the experience of reading these comments and engaging with these comments and her approach to them. And so she kind of lays out in this essay on Unheard what it is that they, particular things that they took issue with. She says, quote, she got this note from the sensitivity readers, "I should not use disfigure, quote unquote, disfigure of a landscape in fraction level 3, as presumably comparing bings or spoil heaps, like garbage heaps, to boils might be harmful to acne sufferers. Nor should I use, quote, handicap in its ordinary sense of to impede, right? And I should prefer the acronym SEN to its original phrase, special education needs, because it's more inclusive. In the book, at one point she writes, I haven't read the book myself, so just a disclaimer, but in the book she writes about apparently her decision in 1992, back in 92 when she was a teacher, to drive a gay student to one of the few gay nightclubs in England, which really struck me as actually bizarre because no teacher, at least in America, would ever drive a student anywhere. There was a student, there was a teacher in the district that I lived in prior to the one I live in now, an art teacher, a tenured art teacher, who was actually let go because she drove a student to the 7-Eleven, which was about 100 yards away from the school. Student was having a rough time, and she put her in the car and drove her to 7-Eleven and got fired for that. So that alone just blew me away to read that she drove this gay student to a gay nightclub. In either event, she, a teacher driving any student to any nightclub, gay or straight or otherwise, was shocking to me. But she drove him to this nightclub, where she kind of watched over him to make sure that he was safe. That got flagged by her sensitivity readers as a, quote, straight white savior trope, quote, could be problematic, end quote. Now, while she's at the nightclub, apparently she becomes stricken with fear on this student's behalf, and she grabs a hold of him when he returns from the dance floor to get a drink. And she says, Liam, she says, I love you. You have to promise me to always use a condom and never get AIDS. And her sensitivity readers say she had made a reductive and rogue remark that comes across as homophobic, end quote. Later on, she says, I am enjoined not to quote from My Antonia by Willa Cather, as it is a, quote, an old novel, end quote, nor to state that homosexuality has historically been taboo in Nepal, as homophobia comes from colonialism, nor to mention that the Taliban were terrorists, nor should I say that more middle-class than working-class children go to university, nor that fetal alcohol syndrome leaves children unable to progress, nor that a long, tight dress restricts movement. I'm accidentally misrepresenting the world, she says, because I'm not aware of my, quote, benevolent racism, end quote. It's exoticizing, they say, when in my section on faith, I show a group of young people from diverse cultures and religions discussing the terrorist attacks of Paris in 2015. It is as if these children, this is what the sensitivity reader said, in quote, it is as if these children and their friendships are especially praiseworthy because of their backgrounds, rather than just treating them as people, as, quote, normal children, end quote. In the end, the sensitivity readers actually recommended that Picador not republish the updated version of Some Kids I Taught. Clancy and Picador went their separate ways, but this is important to note. They went their separate ways without even discussing the sensitivity readers' notes. So it wasn't a direct result of the sensitivity readers having, you know, said, don't republish this book, and it wasn't a case of Picador listening to them. They actually went their separate ways, incidental of the notes that these sensitivity readers put forward. They don't have that kind of power, at least not yet, to separate a publisher from an author, especially an author who had already made them quite a bit of money with this, you know, prize-winning memoir that she had written. The important thing to note here is that these readers, really, what I took away from what she wrote in this essay she wrote, and again, I'll put the link in the show notes. These readers really dug into those blind spots and those tropes and biases that I probably would never have picked up on, right? To be honest, to be fair, this wasn't her case of her using Ooga Booga, right? Or placing a Mexican character under a tree to sleep with a sombrero over his face. You know, it wasn't something really obvious and blatant. When the author becomes impressed by a group of diverse kids talking about a terrorist attack in Paris, I assumed that she was impressed because it was a group of kids talking about things that had geopolitical importance, not that she was impressed because they were diverse. Understand? But those are the subtler ways that a sensitivity reader might be able to expose that kind of soft bigotry or benevolent racism, as her sensitivity readers put it. Ways that that from our positions, we're not thinking about it in those terms. We're just thinking, wow, look at this. A bunch of 16, 17-year-old kids are talking about, like, geopolitics. That's amazing, you know? But the fact that these kids happen to be people of color maybe struck a wrong note or an off note. So I think that's a steal, man, right, of the purpose and the intention of sensitivity readers in the publishing world. And to see them used in young adult fiction makes the argument, I think, even stronger. I suppose because, well, you know, you all just heard that recording of Robinson Crusoe, right? A lot of kids heard those recordings, and perhaps a great many of us even formed some early impressions of indigenous people from that representation that you heard. So, you know, maybe it's even more important at the young adult level. Now let's talk about why I think they're ultimately a problem, or at least talk about some questions that I have about them and some reservations I have. And there's a few ways into this discussion, and I promise you that that whole first half of this recording, that whole first 15, 20 minutes, was not just some fearful throat clearing on my part, right? I wasn't just doing that out of fear. I genuinely want to get this right and to be willing to have my mind changed on this. And I don't think this will be the last time I talk about it. I think, you know, if there is some interest or somebody's out there and listens to this podcast and maybe has something to say or is really, really firmly believes in sensitivity readers, I would be more than willing to have them reach out to me and maybe we can have an actual recorded conversation about it because I want to get this right. I think it's important to the future of writing, of art, of culture. You know, and if you listen to my series on John Gardner, I left off by saying that art delivers the world we deserve to live in. So this is serious business. And I want people to understand that I'm never going to take the don't be so sensitive, it's just words on a page, get a sense of humor, get over it position. I completely understand and I completely sympathize with an American Indian audience member hearing a tribal character say Ooga Booga and being absolutely appalled by it. I get that. I really do. And I think that there should be space for that. Having said that, I think one issue that's important to think about is how you want to define the purpose of a sensitivity reader. Now, if you think the purpose is to help you avoid offending people from marginalized communities, then there's a strong case for removing many of those subtle, soft bigotries, right? Because they're the ones who are going to likely pick up on it immediately, right? So I can absolutely see a gay reader reading that section where Clancy says, don't get AIDS, and being like, ew, like, there's multiple ways to get AIDS. It's not just a gay thing, you jerk, right? You bigot. So I can see that. But if you think the purpose of a sensitivity reader is to avoid promoting harmful stereotypes and tropes to non-marginalized audiences, right? And many sensitivity readers claim that this is the purpose, then I wonder if some of those subtleties are so subtle that they don't really do the harm you think it's going to do and they were never intended to. I think most straight readers, for example, would have read that section where the teacher says don't get AIDS and would have just interpreted it as a concerned teacher taking on a sort of motherly role with her student. And I'm just skeptical that straight readers would hit that line and go, oh, yeah, she's saying that because gays give people AIDS. I forgot. Right. That makes sense. Right. I mean, you see the difference I'm pointing out? It's a long way to basically say that I think there's a tendency to over-exaggerate harm and catastrophize the impact that a character's words might have on our cultural zeitgeist. Does that make sense? I'm just a little bit hesitant to set fire to a person's words based on what I think could be over-exaggerated claims of harm. And this is where I think a lot of the conversation about sensitivity readers gets bogged down because we're not all on the same page about their purpose. And many times people take the position that the purpose is actually both, right? Both of those things. Let's avoid offending people and let's avoid implanting harmful ideas about marginalized groups in non-marginalized people's heads. And there's no real easy way out of that one because they're both noble ideas, right? Now, some sensitivity readers, from what I understand, have taken to calling themselves authenticity readers, and that's fine because that speaks to the second purpose that we just laid out. You want to make sure that writers who are writing about groups outside of their own identity are being accurately portrayed. But here's the thing. Most writers I know, present company included, often, very often, and very early on, reach out to friends, relatives, fellow writers during the revision stage to read for these snares already, Right? It's very rare that a writer develops a character of color, or a male character develops a female character, and doesn't seek to run it by someone they trust to see if it strikes the right chord. Right? Now, if that's your definition of a sensitivity reader, then here's no great matter, right? But there still are some concerns and reservations I have, and I'm just going to talk about them in no particular order. Well, for one, it does strike me as a little odd that a sensitivity reader acts as a sort of stand-in for an entire community, as if this community was some sort of monolith. Now, I know they say in interviews, and I've read some Reddit threads where sensitivity readers have spoken publicly about this, and they say they're not standing in for their community, but in fact, it is sort of what they're doing. I mean, their whole modus operandi is rooted in the idea that a writer not from the community might present something inauthentic or offensive about the community as a whole. And just that position alone makes them necessarily acting as a spokesperson. There's just no way really around that, which strikes me as odd. And it strikes them as odd, too, which is why I think they're hesitant to take on that role. So how do you know you've gotten the right sensitivity reader, so to speak, right? You've gotten the right person who's saying something from a somewhat more objective standpoint. Secondly, I have concerns about sensitivity readers becoming a permanent and sort of inflexible part of the publishing process, the way that agents have become practically, you know, an ironclad requirement for the pathway to publication. I know there are some one-offs. I know there are some rare occasions even where, I mean, I've even heard of people who have self-published their books and ended up securing a book deal from it. But by and large, 90% of the time, if not more than 90% of the time, the books that hit the stands have been represented by an agency or an agent. As it stands at the moment, sensitivity readers are brought very often at the last minute, right, to look over a work that's pretty much on its way to the shelves, right? So they get in there very, very late in the game. But how long do you think it is before they get brought in earlier in the process, perhaps to help with submissions decisions? And that's where I have some concerns, right? So writers could end up getting rejected on the basis of recommendations made by sensitivity readers. Is it hard to imagine Kate Clancy's testimony about how her readers recommended to Picador that they not republish her book happening earlier in the pipeline, and maybe with a lesser known or first time author? It's not that far fetched to imagine that a house would hire sensitivity readers to say, okay, read our slush pile, or here's a group of books we're thinking about going with, read it. And they come back and say, no, this has got problems and this has got this problem, I wouldn't recommend it. And the publishing company kind of says, okay, that makes sense. And then they put the rejection out. Unbeknownst to the author, because as any author would tell you, when we get rejections from publishing houses, from literary magazines, they rarely, if ever, explain why they're rejecting the piece. They rarely say, you know, this isn't right because it's got some problematic lines in it, or this isn't quite, the way it ended was not quite right, or they usually just say that we can't use it at this time, or another famous rejection, I think, is something like, we loved it, but we're not in love with it. And I've heard that before. I'm trying to think about the most recent rejections I've gotten. We can't use it at this time. This is not the right piece for us. You know, they just use a very broad, bland kind of rejection language, you know. But meanwhile, this was going on behind the scenes, unbeknownst to the writer. I could see that happening, you know, I could see that happening down the road with sensitivity readers coming in to help them make editorial decisions, yes or no decisions about whether or not to publish a writer. So that's a concern I have. Another thought I had about it is actually more of a question, and I think I know the answer, and that's if sensitivity readers do become part of the standard operating procedure in the publication process, are they going to be evenly applied across the board? Are sensitivity readers going to be working with, for example, LGBTQ writers to look over how they present straight people? Are they going to work with POC writers to provide feedback on harmful stereotypes they might promote about white people? Are women writers going to be scrutinized over their depictions of men in their work? And if so, how would we avoid such a thing being weaponized to censor and limit those very people and what they're allowed to say in their work, right? Or is it the case that sensitivity screening will only apply to straight white male writers? And if that's the case, then, well, I'll leave that idea for you to think about while you're endorsing here in the arts. I know. I can hear you all breaking out the world's smallest violin from my white male writers. But take a moment to really think about that kind of a scenario, right? Would it be evenly applied? Would it cut in the other direction? And how could you avoid that being weaponized to actually further silence marginalized voices, right? Another consideration, and this is going back to purpose, would a sensitivity reader preclude publishers from publishing novels that contain characters who are bigoted and insensitive, right? Or does the author have to find some way to, quote, push back on the character? In other words, does the racist guy in the book always have to get his comeuppance at the end, or would it be considered an endorsement of racism if the character gets away with it scot-free? Right. A Google search of literary magazine submission guidelines will unearth a lot of the vague ways that editors are communicating their approach to this in their submission guidelines. The language of their submission guidelines ranges from something that's subjective, like, do not submit work to us that is racist, sexist, ableist, or homophobic, to slightly more specific, we do not submit work to us that dwells unnecessarily in or are unchallenging of racism, misogyny, bigotry, and sexual violence. Right, end quote. Those are quotes that I pulled right from submission guidelines, right? So if I submit work to this particular magazine, it cannot unnecessarily dwell on misogyny or racism, and I can't allow the misogyny or racism to go unchallenged in the story. Now, if I want to submit my work to them, I have to trust that they're taking a kind of Justice Scalia approach, which is, you know, I can't define these things, but I know it when I see it. Because I don't know specifically what they mean by unchallenging of. Does that mean what I said before, that the bigoted characters have to get their comeuppance? The moral compass always has to turn away from homophobia. Can a character be flawed in this respect, but ultimately loved by other characters in the story? Or is that an example of the writer not, quote, challenging them? If I have a character who is cleaning out his dead grandmother's house and he stumbles upon a photo of her participating in the anti-integration protests outside of Little Rock, Arkansas, for example, in 1957, what has to happen for that story to pass the gates at these literary magazines? Does the protagonist have to reject his grandmother whole cloth? Does he have to denounce her, piss on a grave? What? What does he have to do? What would be considered sufficiently challenging, right? That word challenge. If the narrator or the protagonist of the story continues to love his grandmother in spite of what he's learned about her, is that viewed as some kind of endorsement of racism and therefore racist? What would a sensitivity reader suggest? We don't know. It's the artistic equivalent of, at least for first-time writers or for novice writers who are still trying to break in, right? It's the artistic equivalent of, you know, hey, you see that hole in the side of that ancient temple wall? Yeah, the one with that's all slimy and full of webs and it's shaped like a lion's mouth. Go stick your hand in there and see what happens, right? You just don't know until you actually go through it. And then even then, you may not know. Your work might be getting rejected time after time and you may not realize why. Which begs another question I have about this. What if one refuses to make the changes sensitivity readers recommend? What are the consequences? Now, I know a little bit about this. Sensitivity readers who have gone on record mostly say that writers, editors can take it or leave it. They're just recommendations. And I guess the position of the sensitivity reader, and I think it's a good position, is I warned you and you didn't listen, right? Because then the consequences come from the audience, the readership. If a book is full of gratuitous racial slurs and celebrates homophobia, there's going to be a public backlash. There's no question about that. The job of the sensitivity reader is to rescue publishers and authors from that backlash. And if they don't listen, well, then pity about them, right? But how long did or will that dynamic last is my question, right? Or what if the publisher agrees with the findings of the readers or the reader, but the writer doesn't agree? And I can hear people out there saying, well, the publisher has the right of free association. If they don't want to publish something they think is insensitive, you can't force them to publish it, and that's true. But what if the publisher's operating out of fear rather than, you know, a genuine sense that the manuscript is morally off or might strike the wrong note with people? Or does that not even matter? Here's another question, since I'm asking so many questions. What's to become of transgressive fiction? An entire genre of fiction where characters will often run afoul of social norms. What would have been the fate of A Clockwork Orange if it had fallen into the hands of sensitivity readers? What chance would Fight Club have against accusations of misogyny and ableism? What about Lolita? My God, right? Or the anti-Semitism in Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, or even in Ulysses. So my guess would be that writers wishing to have characters that transgress our social expectations would be relegated to the dark, kind of marginal corners of the publishing industry, no? Because, you know, the editors at the New Yorker or Granta, the New England Review, would have fallen over themselves to publish a chapter of Lolita, but they wouldn't dare do it now. Right? Which brings me to the reason sensitivity readers have been in the news lately. Many of those classics, like ones I just mentioned before, are actually being retroactively updated to suit modern audiences by publishing houses that are hiring sensitivity readers as consultants. Now, a few weeks ago, it was announced that the late Roald Dahl's books would be getting a reprint, sans the original book's offensive or insensitive words. So no longer will Augustus Gloop be called fat or the witch is ugly. One of the more interesting parts of this controversy is the revelation that, yeah, there are now actual consulting firms that rent out sensitivity readers at the behest of publishing companies. So a business model that was once pretty exclusively independent contractors seeking freelance opportunities, working sort of as independent contractors, has now been kind of industrialized and organized into firms. And the organization that behind Dahl's revision is a consultant firm called Inclusive Minds, right? A consultancy firm. The wheels of commerce will forever turn, won't they? Where is their website? I could pull up their website to talk a little bit about who they are, right? One moment. So in their About Us section, for example, you know, just their About section, they launched over 10 years. They played a valuable role in helping to raise awareness, I'm quoting from the website, of the importance of better and more authentic inclusion in children's books. The organization has always evolved with the changing needs of the industry, and as awareness of the need for diversity inclusion has dramatically risen in recent years, there is less need for Inclusive Minds to campaign for books to be inclusive and a greater need for the practical service we offer in terms of helping ensure authenticity. So initially, I guess their mission was to include more people from marginalized communities. Now it's now that you've included them, now you need to accurately portray them. That's kind of one of their missions. Inclusive Minds do not edit or rewrite text, which is good, right? But they provide book creators with valuable insight from people with the relevant lived experience that they can take into consideration in the wider process of writing and editing. Over the years, many children's book publishers in the UK, from small independents to members of the big five publishing houses, have contacted us to be connected with our network of inclusion ambassadors. This is a network of young people with many different lived experiences who are willing to share their insight to help them in the process of creating authentically and often incidentally inclusive books. They're not sensitivity readers. They are called inclusion ambassadors. There's a difference. We encourage book creators, I get writers, right? Usually publishers and sometimes authors and illustrators to ask to connect with the network at the earliest possible stage of a book's development so that inclusion ambassadors can share nuances related to their lived experience as characters are created and plots are developed. This makes it very different from sensitivity reading. Involving our ambassadors is not about cutting potentially controversial content, but rather about including and embedding authenticity and inclusive voices and experiences from the outset. These connections provide valuable insight that complements the many other forms of research an author will use to ensure authentic inclusion. Occasionally, publishers approach us to consult inclusion ambassadors when looking to reprint older titles, and this is where their role came in with Roald Dahl's work. Whilst this is not the main focus for the ambassadors, and we believe better authenticity is achieved through input at development stages, We do think those with lived experience can provide valuable input when it comes to reviewing language that can be damaging and perpetuate harmful stereotypes. In all our work with marginalized young people, the very real negative impact and damage caused to self-worth and mental health from biased, stereotypical, and inauthentic representation is a recurring theme. On any project is the role of the ambassador to help identify language and portrayals that could be inauthentic or problematic, and to highlight why, as well as indicate potential solutions. The publisher and our author are then able to make informed decisions regarding what changes they wish to make to manuscripts and illustrations. Inclusive Minds is here to connect people with relevant lived experience to help in the wider process, and do not edit or rewrite text. They actually mentioned that twice in their about me section. So that's Inclusive Minds, who was behind the Roald Dahl edits. So the late Roald Dahl, I should say, an author who died a while ago. So now it's not just a matter of changing Willy Wonka's Augustus Gloop from enormously fat to enormous. There are whole sentences that have been rewritten to deliver either some, you know, inclusive message or to flatten out a detail that might strike the 2023 reader as odd. So take, for example, this passage from Witches. Here's the original. Don't be foolish, my grandmother said. You can't go round pulling the hair of every lady you meet, even if she is wearing gloves. Just you try it and see what happens. This got changed to, don't be foolish, my grandmother said. Besides, there are plenty of other reasons why women might wear wigs, and there is certainly nothing wrong with that. Here's more from Willy Wonka and his explanation of the Oompa Loompas. Willy Wonka says in the original, so I shipped them all over here, every man, woman, and child in the Oompa Loompa tribe. That got changed to, so they all agreed to come over, each and every Oompa Loompa. In the original, he says, it was easy. I smuggled them over in large packing cases with holes in them, and they all got here safely. They all speak English now. And that got changed to, they've told me they love it here. So I'm gathering that the people at Inclusive Minds thought that Wonka's description of how the Oompa Loompas arrived at the factory harkens back to the transatlantic slave trade. And this is the depth to which they will dive to kind of unearth some of these subtle, what they call unconscious biases, right? Which begs my next question about this. And that is, what do we do then about the intersection of art and activism? Now this is a complicated question because we all know art can be activism, right? Upton Sinclair's The Jungle fostered change for workers' rights. To Kill a Mockingbird shed light, for white audiences at least, on the ugliness of racial prejudice. Films like Philadelphia humanized the AIDS epidemic. So art leads, and art has the ability to bring forth the conversations necessary to affect change. So in some ways, art can be activism. So it's not an answer to say, as some might want to say, you know, get activism out of fiction, get activism out of publishing. Now, that very conversation is actually happening where I do think it's appropriate, and that's in the realm of journalism, where more and more journalists are saying, you know, if you want to be a journalist, fine, then adhere to the tenets of this profession and report on things accurately and without editorializing. But if you want to change the world, then go be an activist. Don't subject journalism, and by extension, journalists, to an activist's insatiable standards. Now, we can't say that with art, but I think we need to be honest about this and admit that art can sometimes suffer when activism takes precedence over artistic expression, over an artist's recreation and vision of the world as it is. And so I ask again, to what extent might sensitivity readers, who really are activists, I don't think it's unfair to categorize in that way, that's what they are, in a sense that they're trying to, they have an agenda that they're trying to materialize, right, and make a real world change on. To what extent might sensitive readers stifle the artistic expressions and utterances of writers? And I know I glossed over it a little bit snarkily, but another question I have is the economics of the thing, right? When I talked about the commerce, right, the wheels of commerce. One thing that has dogged the activist world for a while now is this notion that activism has no end, and it especially has no end when there is financial incentive to keep it going. So that creates this sort of feedback loop where you start to wonder, is the problem still there, or is the money being generated to address the problem keeping the problem there? Now, fortunately for me, that's not my domain to explore, but an offshoot of this is the fact that sensitivity readers are getting paid for this work. And clearly, there's an industry for this kind of service. And from what I understand, if you're to believe sensitivity readers, it's not lucrative. But hang on, it'll get there. Especially if more and more publishing houses start reaching out to professional firms to take on their titles, right? Or even if, even more so, if publishing houses start carving out office space to bring this work in-house, it's going to create a whole new job description, a whole new mid-management level, right? The sky's the limit. And I'm not even counting, you know, the inevitable grifters that are bound to come down from the mountain and weaponize this with, you know, intimidation tactics, right? Just leaving those people aside, because that's probably a small group of the people who would make up this group of sensitivity readers. Now, what do I mean by that? What I mean is, once the dominoes start to fall and more publishing houses are making sensitivity readers a permanent part of their process, any house that refuses to carve out space for this will start to feel the pressure, right, to do so. Here's another question. I would have to ask sensitivity readers this, but has there ever been a case where a sensitivity reader was asked to look over a work of fiction and they did so and came back to the publishing house and said, nope, all good, no problems, you're good to go? And I think you know the answer to that, right? Because that's just human nature. God shield I from being a cynic, but I'm not sure it's a healthy environment to have someone reading a book for offensive material when that person's livelihood depends on finding offensive material, right? Or to put it more simply, those who go looking for offense will find it every time, right? Here's what my gut is telling me, and maybe it's just a consequence of spending too much time on Twitter and too much time online. I think a lot of this is an offshoot, a sort of cousin of deplatforming and no platforming trends, right? I think this can easily be seen as a power grab. If we can control the product, particularly artistic product, we can control the culture. And since we can't arrest people for saying things we don't like, we can hound them and harass them and intimidate them into either saying what we like or not saying anything at all. Obviously, it starts with the easy targets, the ones almost everyone can agree on, right? Alex Jones, Milo Yiannopoulos, Richard Spencer, Nick Fuentes, Carl Benjamin, right? But then the circle widens, right, to Joe Rogan, Jordan Peterson, Christina Hoff Sommers, right? None of these people have anything to do with fiction or with sensitivity reading, so I don't want you to get confused. But they are interesting case studies, and I think you can draw dots between how they've been treated and how less powerful, more agreeable, lesser known, more vulnerable people in publishing have been treated. There's a growing attitude among intellectuals in literature and publishing that deplatforming people, deplatforming works of fiction or poetry, is not only desirable but should be applauded, right? And I'm wondering how sensitivity readers might be another method to accomplish this. And I wonder this because of people like Maris Kreitzman, for example. Now, Maris Kreitzman is a writer and an influential Twitter personality. She's got more than 75,000 followers on Twitter. Now, she was shocked and appalled, actually, by the bolderizing of Roald Dahl's work. But she shouldn't have been, in my estimation, because her history of censoriousness when it comes to literature is well documented, and gratefully by Kreitzman herself, right? In a Twitter thread that she posted just last July, Kreitzman responded to an opinion piece by Pamela Paul, who is a former New York Times book review editor. And in the piece that drew Kreitzman's ire, Paul argued that there's a new form of book banning underway, and it's coming from the left. Similar to how conservatives have gotten many books banned from school libraries, and they continue to do so, a certain subset of progressives have put enormous pressure on publishers, reviewers, booksellers, reading venues to, quote, not platform books by writers they have deemed harmful to society. And in the Twitter thread, Kreitzman called attention to one book that argues against publishing, quote, white supremacists, fascists, misogynists, and other dangerous ideologues, end quote. And then she goes on to provide links to articles about people who presumably fall into one or more of these categories. Woody Allen, Abigail Schreier, Janine Cummins, Michael Cohen, Alan Dershowitz, Brett Stevens, you name it. She supported employees at Hatchet who threatened to walk out if they published Woody Allen's memoir, Apropos of Nothing. And then she, when Apropos of Nothing, when Hatchet acquiesced and they canceled their contract with Woody, his memoir ended up getting published by a company called Skyhorse Publishing. They ended up publishing Apropos of Nothing. Kreitzman signal boosted a hit piece in Vanity Fair about Skyhorse Publishing, right? And that's one of the few houses out there that will publish contrarian or controversial writers or books that challenge, you know, well-worn progressive narratives. And she embedded an article in support of, wait for it, sensitivity readers. So all part of this Twitter thread that she created, right towards the end, she talked about, you know, the need for sensitivity readers. So I think there is an intellectual kinship between the people who seek to see book contracts rescinded or not offered and the people who seek to keep a watchful eye on writers and the way they go about constructing characters. They're cut from the same cloth. And as far as using sensitivity readers for past fiction, like to give a once-over without the consent of the writer, that to me is a non-starter. It happened to Roald Dahl, and just recently Agatha Christie got the same treatment from her work. Now, Christie's novels contain some dialogue that's pretty blatantly anti-Semitic, and it goes unchallenged, right, as they say. I think one could maybe argue that Christie was making a social point about how, you know, nonchalant the anti-Semitism was in the 1930s England, but it's entirely possible she thought she was having a bit of a joke at the expense of Jewish people and nobody, you know, called her out for it. That's possible, too. Either way, I don't think it should be touched, to be honest. I mean, it is what it is. And maybe it's good that we see how artists have evolved over the decades or the centuries. I mean, imagine if we started painting over the murals of ancient Egypt because it lacks foreshortening and isn't accurate to human anatomy. I mean, can you imagine the outcry? Right? Nobody would support such a thing. And the history of our art is there to provide milestones to see how it has evolved. It doesn't need to be sanitized. It serves no one to do this. But, you know, even the most staunch supporters of sensitivity readers, like Kreitzman herself, has come out against this. You know, so I don't think it has the weight of our cultural forces behind it, at least at the moment. Believe it or not, we actually found something that absurd we can all agree on that. So those are my overall thoughts on sensitivity readers. I think they're a solution looking for a problem. In a lot of ways, they can be. I think the spirit that guides them can be benevolent and valuable. But I'm torn also, to be fair about it, right? Because I think that they can be stifling to artistic expression. I think they could be weaponized by people with financial incentives, people motivated by resentment and the inclination to control other artists. And if we start to see them brought in-house, all right, as a permanent part of the process, I think we'll start to see really sanitized, idealized fiction that isn't honest or raw or troubling to deal with. And boy, what will that look like for the art of fiction? I'm sure there are some of you who might disagree or have something to add, so please reach out to me. I'm at MatthewMcEvna@gmail.com. If you'd like to maybe come on the show and talk to me further about this, it's probably not the last time I'll speak about it, but I think it's probably a good start and a good time to stop. excuse me. And if I do happen to come fully around on this and change my thinking, of course, I'll record that too. For now, until next time, I'm Matthew McEvna. This is The Ink Drop. Thank you for listening, and you take care of yourself. Hellcat.